Hello, everybody. This is Georgianne Hughes, and this is The Bite Show. And tonight, we have the privilege of talking with a gentleman. His name is David Seeloff. He had worked with Ernest Martin, and you can find this website, Associates for Scriptural Knowledge, and it is just http://askelm.com. That's askelm.com. Hello, David.
Hello, Georgianne.
Golly, tell our listeners about yourself and the work that you've been doing.
Well, basically, the work that I'm doing at present is I'm carrying on the work of Dr. Ernest L. Martin.
Right.
The author of several books on biblical subjects. And my personal background, I'll, you know, get into in a moment, but Dr. Ernest Martin is the author of 8 or 9 books. Some of the books are kind of small, but major works, about 6 of them, dealing with biblical subjects of research over 30 years. And one of his later books was The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot.
Yes.
And he's written other books called the Restoring the Original Bible, which deals about the correct book order of the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
The Star That Astonished the World, which is about the Bethlehem star.
Yeah.
We're announcing the birth of Christ, which 600 planetariums have switched to. He wrote a book called 101 Bible Secrets That Christians Do Not Know, kind of a Reader's Digest format, and a book called The People That History Forgot.
I have that book, and boy, is that a great book.
Right. It deals with the mysterious people who originated the world's religion and deals with Gnosticism.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating book. Another book, 500 pages, is one called The Secrets of Golgotha, which deal with the location and the means of Christ's crucifixion, everything that took place. So he's written books that cover the field from the birth of Christ, the crucifixion of Christ, the development of the early church, location of the temples, and his final work, and his cap of biblical studies is a book called The Essentials of New Testament Doctrine, which puts his biblical understanding, particularly of the New Testament, all together in one package. So a number of these books are 500 pages or more, but they're jam-packed with information.
Boy, they're well worth reading. The one that I have, I wouldn't part with it. It has got so much information in it. Wow.
My own personal background, I have a history degree from the University of Wisconsin in Madison and a master's in theology and biblical studies from Fuller Seminary in Pasadena, California.
Mm-hmm.
I also worked for 9 years at Fuller Seminary working on the professional books and papers of the professors, typesetting and editing, line editing their work. I started editing Dr. Martin's work while I was working at Fuller, and then when he died, he had designated me to carry on his work, and he has produced some 400 audio tapes, many of which are able to convert into text and go into further detail on many of the subjects even beyond his books. Not beyond his books, but certainly in a little bit more detail, because he was a researcher. He'd cover one thing and then he'd move on to something else and never actually go back to what's interesting to me and to many other people, but not, you know, no longer interested him because he'd been there, done that.
Well, he was very prolific,
yeah.
You know, my goodness, and gifted. I think that the Holy Spirit was with Dr. Martin.
And eventually we're looking to put all the best of the best on the website, audio, video, primarily print material.
Yeah.
And so that's what we're doing, picking up some of the best biblical information that anyone will find anywhere.
And you also, I think on your website, askelm.com, I think there are books that people can download?
Correct. We have 7 books that are available for download.
And they're free?
They're free, yeah.
Oh.
101 Bible Secrets, a short book called ABCs of the Gospel.
Mm-hmm.
Then the Essentials of New Testament Doctrine, like I said. Restoring the Original Bible, The People That History Forgot. The Star of Bethlehem, the Star That Astonished the World. And a very interesting book called The Tithing Dilemma.
Oh, yes.
Deals with the tithing controversy. And I'm not here to be provocative right now, but there's very interesting information in that booklet that will shock many people.
Well, I'm sure. I've heard of this book, and that's one that I want to get because I think the blood of our Lord and Savior was the ultimate tithe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know? And I know that people don't quite think of it that way.
No, that's an interesting concept. Right?
Yeah.
On the website, in the center, is a picture of the Jerusalem Temple as Dr. Martin developed it and understood it. He was originally approached by Professor Ori Mazar, the son of Benjamin Mazar, the famous archaeologist in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Professor Benjamin Mazar led the dig at what everyone thought was the Temple Mount in Jerusalem on the southwest and southern edge of what's called today the Haram Esh-Sharif. Dr. Martin supervised the students from 1968 to 73. The dig continued some years after that with Barani Reich and even Alat Mazar and other archaeologists. But Dr. Martin got immersed in archaeology at that time and his interest in the temple. In 1995, he started researching information that was given to him by Ori Mazar, who had a doctorate in archaeology, as well as, and he said, Ori Mazar said that Professor Benjamin Mazar stated to him that he thought maybe the temple was not on the Haram Esh-Sharif.
Mm-hmm.
Ori Mazar unfortunately lied to Dr. Martin, but Dr. Martin didn't know at that time.
Oh,
Dr. Martin went and researched what Ori Mazar had told him and found that indeed it was true through Josephus and historical works that the temple, none of the Jewish temples were built on the Haram Esh-Sharif, which is where the Dome of the Rock is at present.
Now, does this still hold true, David?
Yes, his research further confirmed it, and other work by other people, such as Professor George Wesley Buchanan, have confirmed it, and it's in academic discussions back and forth at the present time.
Mm-hmm.
A second edition of the book will be coming out in the future, time unknown, but it's fully re-edited with updated material. The information is that the temples, if you go to the website, you'll be able to see the diagram, and if you click on the diagram on the graphic, you will be able to see in detail a larger picture.
Mm-hmm.
The temples were south of the Haram Esh-Sharif, about one-third of a mile, just west and above the Gihon Springs. The Gihon Springs is the only source of water in the entire Jerusalem area within a 5-mile radius.
Yeah, and isn't it that you could not have a temple without it having the water, right?
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
All the tabernacles had water. Remember
yes.
the incident in the wilderness?
Yes.
There was no water. And the Moses sinned and struck the rock without waiting for God's command.
Right.
That water came from within the temple area and was used for, I'm sorry, the tabernacle, and was used for the tabernacle. The tabernacle was always set up with access to what's called living water, running water, water from cisterns, or even aqueducts is inadequate for the Temple Mount for purification, for waters that are needed for purification. Now, waters that are used to flush away the waste,
right?
That water can, of course, be used, any kind of water. It doesn't have to be the purest of the pure water. But the water that went into the laver for purification of the priests and purification of the altar after the sacrifices were made,
mm-hmm.
where it was burnt for the cleansing of the utensils, that had to be of the purest quality water, and there is no such water on the Haram al-Sharif. And the Jews know this, and if you recall, several years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, there was water that started leaking out of one of the walls on the Haram and outside of the Haram. And everyone got excited and said, oh, it's a miracle, God is showing us where the water. It was a leak in a pipe that the Muslims had put in there.
Oh, my goodness.
There is no natural source of water from any of the archaeologists that have gone there, from any of the Muslims, and Muslims love water. The
mm-hmm.
Muslims, in terms of the Arabs, loved water. The Arabs who conquered Jerusalem would not have covered up a spring of water.
No.
Not in the desert.
Yeah.
And wherever they went, they cultivated water sources.
Right.
And the only water source is at the Gihon Springs, one-third of a mile south of the Haram al-Sharif. Now, once Dr. Martin understood this, he read Josephus, and Josephus suddenly makes sense. Everything makes sense. The battle scenes, the historical aspects, absolutely everything makes sense. And Dr. Martin actually concluded his research. That his research showed that the temples of God in Jerusalem were located over the Gihon Spring and not over the Dome of the Rock. And the political importance of this, if this is accepted by Jewish scholars and Christian scholars and Muslim scholars don't have much problem with this, because they've always said that it was not on Haram al-Sharif.
Mm-hmm.
The difficulty with Muslim scholarship on this issue is that they often say that the temples never existed, but they did exist, and they were located over the Gihon Springs.
How can they say it never existed?
They deny the textual, the direct textual evidence of the scriptures, and they generally don't take historical accounts too seriously, although many of the scholars do, but the theologians do not, the Muslim theologians. The Christian scholars and theologians never really dealt with the issue. And the reason that the correct site of the temples was lost, first by the Christians, then by the Muslims, and then by the Jews themselves, was because of dreams and visions.
Oh, my goodness.
Told them that it was over here, not over there. And this is all documented in Dr. Martin's work.
I'll be darned. I've never... That, I don't remember reading or hearing about. That's fascinating.
Now, that's in several of the articles. We have an entire section on the website under articles that has the Temple Update Articles Index.
Okay.
And we have Doctrinal Articles Index and a Prophecy Index for prophetic prophecy articles. So there's a wealth of material on the website. Reading Josephus, using Dr. Martin's illustration, and it's an illustration, nobody knows exactly what it looks like, but for example, the water issue, once again, There was an author, a Jewish author. Well, first of all, let's start out with what Jesus said.
Okay.
Jesus said to his disciples they were on the Mount of Olives, and the disciples said, look at the buildings of the temple. Has anyone ever seen anything that great? And Jesus said to them that there shall not be left one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down.
Right.
If you go to the Haram Esh-Sharif, all you see are 10,000 stones, one upon another.
Oh, my goodness.
And when I went there in 1983 on a tour with Dr. Martin, I asked him that. And this was, 12 years before he ever began to look into this matter. And he said, oh, well, that only refers to the temple and to the city. But no, that's not what Jesus said. And Dr. Martin realized this later on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, other people had pointed that out to him, and he had always given the traditional answer, because that's the only thing that they had information on. Now, Jesus said that there would be not one stone upon another that would not be thrown down.
That's right.
That is exactly the case for the location by the Gihon Spring. There is no stone upon another. And actually, this is confirmed by Josephus, who, in his book, The Wars of the Jews, Josephus, an eyewitness who turned coat from the Jews and went to the Roman side,
mm-hmm.
but still an eyewitness, he wrote that, quote, Caesar ordered the whole city and the temple to be razed to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
That the wall encompassing the city was so completely leveled to the ground as to leave future visitors to the spot no ground for believing that it had ever been inhabited. That's the city and the temple. The temple was completely razed to the ground.
Now, pardon my ignorance in this mm-hmm. issue, but is this is this what we would call Jerusalem?
Yes. Actually, Dr. Martin originally believed that a fortress that the Haram Esh-Sharif is the remains of Fortress Antonia, which was constructed by Herod
mm-hmm.
after the model of a Roman, typical permanent Roman fortress in the time of Herod to protect the temple, one third of a mile north of the temple.
Right.
And there was a connection between the Fortress Antonia, the Haram Esh-Sharif, and the temple, so that the military or the police could quickly get into the temple area without having to go through the regular doors, so that during a riot, which happened often,
yeah.
everybody says that happened a lot,
yeah.
Josephus and the Roman historians and everybody, there were always infighting. Philo says the same thing. The Jews were always fighting amongst themselves, and order had to be maintained. So Herod built this magnificent structure called the Fortress Antonia. The remains of the Haram Esh-Sharif, where the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque are located, at the present time, is the remains of Fortress Antonia. And that was not considered part of the city of Jerusalem by the Jews, because it was polluted by Gentiles.
Okay.
By the presence of the Romans.
Yeah.
And was never really properly purified. So that they didn't feel obligated to purify it when the Jews took over. So the Romans didn't totally destroy that. They left some towers and obviously some structures that are there today. Some of those stones are incredibly massive.
Mm.
And they're still one upon another. Now, either Jesus' prophecy was false, and at the time of the destruction, he was simply wrong. Or it did take place, but it took place at a different location, and in fact, that's what took place.
That it did happen, but at a different location.
Right, above the Gihon Springs.
Uh-huh.
Exactly where you would expect a temple to be built, where the water is required for purification.
Okay.
Now, we've had a U.S. geological survey hydrologist go over the information, and he said yes. And he had just been to Jerusalem and seen the Gihon Spring, the nature of the spring, and it gushed much, much more than it does today. Its volume was tremendous, and the Bible attests to it, tremendous flow of water, whereas now it's just a trickle. But in the old days, it was just huge, the amount of water. He said that the nature of that spring is such that it is like a geyser under pressure. It's not heated, so there's no geyser effect with steam, but it's under pressure so that several times a day it would bubble up as a fountain, you know, several times a day under pressure. And this is exactly what the historical records show. For example, there's a gentleman by the name of Aristeas, a Jewish traveler, in 250 BC. Now, this is before the Romans ever set eyes on Jerusalem, by about about 70 years before. And Aristeas says that as an eyewitness, now this is before King Herod, about 200 years before King Herod, he said that the temple faces east. He's an eyewitness. And the whole of the floor slopes down to the appointed places that the water may be conveyed to wash away the blood of the sacrifices. For many thousands of beasts are sacrificed there on the feast days, which is exactly what we understand from the biblical information.
Right.
This was after the return from the exile to Jerusalem, after the Hasmonean Empire rose and fell, or rose. It was during the Hasmoneans, actually, and they had built another temple after Zerubbabel, and actually they redid it and enlarged it, and then Herod enlarged it again. And it was magnificent in Aristeas' day. And Aristeas goes on to say that that, quote, there is an inexhaustible supply of water because an abundant natural spring gushes up from within the temple area. Now, this is remarkable because there's nothing like this on the Haram Esh-Sharif. There are massive water cisterns for collecting rainwater and runoff, but this is exactly what you would expect for a fortress to withstand a siege.
Sure.
You would need water for the temple, and it has to be natural spring water, and this is exactly what Aristeas says in 250 B.C. The copper scroll in about the 60s C.E., before the temple was destroyed, right before the temple was destroyed, the copper scroll says, in the mouth of the fountain of the Beth Shem, there is silver and gold vessels and silver coins weighing 600 talents. Now, the fountain of the Beth Shem is another phrase meaning the fountain of the temple. The house Beth Shem means the house of the name. Now, if you go on the ASK website, I wrote a short article showing how often the temple is designated as the house of the name, the Beth Shem.
Okay, now, is this like Shem in...
No, Shem is the common Hebrew word for name.
Okay.
So the house of the name, they couldn't say the house of Yahweh.
Right.
Like you and I as Gentiles can say that,
right.
But a Jew cannot, even today. But the fountain of the Beth Shem, the fountain of the house of the name, it's saying that before the Herodian temple was destroyed, there was a fountain in that temple. Because that's what Beth Shem means. It doesn't mean anything else. You can't use a geographical designation and say that's like, you know, St. Louis. You can't use the term Beth Shem, house of the name. It always means the temple, especially in the copper scroll and the Dead Sea Scroll. And in the scriptures, in the Old Testament. Then further, Tacitus, 30 years after the destruction of Jerusalem, almost 40 years, he wrote, from records obviously, that the temple resembled a citadel. In other words, the temple itself was like a fortress, and it had its own walls. Quote, it contained an inexhaustible spring, and there were subterranean excavations in the hill and tanks and cisterns for holding water. Now, those tanks and cisterns for holding water were all around the temple area. That's what Aristeas says in another portion. So you have Aristeas in 250 B.C., roughly, you have the Copper Scroll stating that in sometime in the 60s, just before the war started,
right.
And then you have Tacitus, some 39 years after the war, all saying the same thing, that there was a spring, a fountain, inside the temple. And then you have many, many biblical Old Testament accounts that talk about water in the Solomonic Temple before the Solomonic Temple was destroyed. So it follows the pattern from the tabernacle, and it actually, Dr. Martin has written an article making the connection between the Eden story and the temple symbolism. It's called The Temple Symbolism in Genesis. It's a remarkable story. There was water in Eden.
Right.
The water flowed out of Eden where God was. The water always flowed through the tabernacle. Fresh water. Fresh water was always there wherever they set up the tabernacle. At Bethel, wherever the tabernacle was set up, there was fresh water. At the Jordan River, before they crossed, when they crossed, and in the land, there was always fresh water because that's where they put the tabernacle. There was fresh water at the time of Solomon's temple, and they rebuilt the temple at the same location every time, and the water was there until when the temple was rebuilt at the time of the exile, the return of the Jews from Babylon,
right.
And also at the time of Herod's expansion of the temple. He expanded it to the north and to the west. He doubled the size, and they built a new Holy of Holies. They continued the old one while they built the new one, because the expansion was such a size that they were able to literally have two side by side. And once they dedicated the new Holy of Holies, which was certainly acceptable because Jesus went to that temple,
right.
Then they demolished the old one. So there's a lot of evidence that there was water there. And in the Babylonian Talmud, it talks about Rabbi Eleazar ben Jacob in Yoma 77b. In the Babylonian Talmud, it says, quote, hence go forth the waters which will bubble forth from under the threshold of the sanctuary. So the Jews know that there has to be water underneath the sanctuary.
Well, they certainly wouldn't violate what God had laid down for them.
Right.
In their construction, building, in their choice of a location.
Right. Well, if once they can accept the correct location, I've spoken with some interesting Muslim people, some pretty high up, and they have said that the Saudis will help the Jews rebuild the temple if this could be accepted. So obviously there would be a political rapprochement on this issue between Jews and Muslims.
Mm.
However, you're going against a lot of tradition
of
Christians and the Jews and the Muslims, because some Muslims, like to keep the controversy going.
Sure.
However, The ones that I've talked to and shown this, I've even given a PowerPoint presentation, a lecture, to a few Muslim groups, and they think this is really, they get excited about this. You know, I could go through a number of Psalms that talk about, you know, the fountain of life, and Yahweh is seated upon the waters. Psalm 87, all my springs are in you, meaning the temple in Zion. Ezekiel 47 talks, if you're familiar with the story of Ezekiel, about the vision of the temple, that the waters issued out from under the threshold of the house.
David,
Ezekiel 47:1.
David, you know, a lot of people talk about Zion, Zion this, Zion that. Zion, you know, in our terms, I mean, we're here in the corporeal world. I'm also told that Zion is a physical location in Jerusalem somewhere.
Right.
Can you talk about that?
Well, that's my understanding. They used to think that Zion was, in the 1800s, used to think that Zion was way in the western part of the city.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it's where the city of David is, and it's exactly where the temple is, according to Dr. Martin and Professor Buchanan and some others, and is in that entire area around the Gihon Spring, but up at the top of the hill. And as it expanded, Zion did in fact shift its location. Wherever God was, that's where Zion was. So there's that aspect there too.
Yeah.
And most of your modern Bible dictionaries will tell you the truth about Zion, and it'll probably be pretty accurate. So just in the prophecy of Joel, it talks about, in Joel 3, verse 18, it says, quote, all the rivers of Judah shall flow with waters, and a fountain shall come forth up from the house of Yahweh, from the house of the Lord, and shall water the valley of Shittim. That's farther down, you know, down in the valley after Kidron. So, you know, there's water down there, and the water is still flowing today. I was there a year and a half ago, and I saw it. It used to be quite bad water, but now it's fresh again, which is actually a very, very interesting and a good sign that the water is fresh again. What that means, I certainly can't say, but it is interesting. To George Adam Smith, in his book, Jerusalem Topography, Economics, and History, said, quote, the Gihon Spring is Jerusalem's only supply of fresh water in antiquity, period. And south of this hill, where the Gihon Spring is located, is another minor water source, the Rogel Spring, but that's only a well. Now, if you read Josephus, there was an aqueduct built by Pontius Pilate, which was very controversial, to bring water to Jerusalem. And they almost had, of course, the Jews rioted, and they had to be suppressed. But eventually they accepted it once because, why? Because the temple was using so much water that they had to find another source of water from a distance to bring it into the city, because the temple was using so much water. So it's very, very interesting. And it all ties together once you have the correct location. Nothing makes sense if you have the temple. The historical records do not make sense if you consider the temple being on the Haram al-Sharif. And, you know, the southern wall of the Haram is breaking down, and there's everybody's excited, and, you know, well, that's not the site of the temple. That's the site of the old fortress Antonia. So the Dome of the Rock was built on the site of the center of the Roman administration, right in the center of the fortress, which was immediately over what was probably the remains of a pagan Roman temple.
That's what the Dome of the Rock covers today?
Correct. Now, it was also probably the site of the what's called the Bema. The Bema is the judgment seat. That's where it's a legitimate historical site. That's where Jesus was very likely judged by Pilate.
Oh, my.
So it's a legitimate site for that reason. But, and there was an octagonal Christian church built on that site before the Muslims took over Jerusalem, after the time of Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a long history, but there's nothing particularly sacred to Christians or to Jews of that piece of territory, except tradition.
Yeah, this Dome of the Rock.
Correct.
Well,
now, if they would give that up, if they would be willing to give that up, the Muslims would be very, very, very accommodating and would consider that a sign of cooperation and goodwill on the part of the Jews. However, you talk to Jews about this, and even at the academic conferences, Dr. Martin would set up a booth, and we would have Jewish scholars walk by, and they would look at his diagram, and they would just laugh and scoff.
Oh, dear.
Until they sat down and talked with him.
Yeah.
And then they started to question things, because he's got a lot of evidence, and there's really no solid evidence against it, except tradition. The usual response is by a lot of scholars, Christians as well as Jewish scholars, is, well, you know, that many people over 2,000 years couldn't be wrong. How could they have lost it? Well, Dr. Martin explains that, and it was essentially dreams and visions overcoming historical eyewitness accounts. Obvious, including Jewish accounts.
Yeah.
And the complex under the Gihon, by the Gihon Spring, is an entire, it's a huge water complex. There's places for storing water, there's places where if you would shut the water off and if the water is under pressure, it's obvious that it would go up Warren's shaft. I personally think there's undiscovered water situations that were closed off during the many and various earthquakes that have occurred in that area. So Josephus says that the only structure in Jerusalem, that Jerusalem was destroyed to its very foundations, but the only structure that survived was the camp of those that destroyed Jerusalem, which means the Romans,
right,
which was Antonia, and which still existed upon the ruins, according to Josephus. Now, Josephus is quoting Eleazar, who's writing from Masada, and, you know, he's putting words into Eleazar's mouth. But Josephus was an eyewitness, and this was typical poetic storyteller's license in those days. It's really not out of bounds. Now, most people, most scholars, every representation of the temple that you will see, it shows Fortress Antonia as a little, what Dr. Martin used to call, a little postage stamp up in the corner, in the northwest corner of this huge complex where supposedly the temple was located,
mm-hmm,
on the Haram al-Sharif. Well, Josephus says that Fortress Antonia held a legion of troops, which is 5,000 to 6,000 men. Plus, they always had an equal number of support personnel, almost all of which were Gentiles, both the troops and the support personnel. You're talking between 10 and 12,000 people, which is exactly what you would need in a structure that size, as big as Fortress Antonia, to handle the number of people that would come into Jerusalem on the feast day.
Yeah.
Jerusalem was a big convention town.
Yeah.
Twice a year, the people would come in and flood the city. And, they would stay in inns and you know, they couldn't find room at the inn, so they had to stay in the stable. That's how far out from the city of Jerusalem, 8 miles, Bethlehem is 8 miles from Jerusalem, that's how far they had to stay during the feast. Apparently, the Dr. Martin shows in his book on the birth of Christ that the census occurred on near the time of feasts. That's why they couldn't find any room at the inn, the fall feasts, actually near the Feast of Trumpets. So the Jerusalem was a big convention town twice a year. It's like the Hajj in Mecca.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once a year, 2 million people gather to do the Hajj. Well, in Jerusalem, about 200,000 to 300,000 people would come into Jerusalem, expanding the size of the city anywhere from five to ten times its normal size. So you needed 5,000 to 6,000 men just to keep order during the feast days by the Romans. Josephus says that Fortress Antonia was the size of a city.
Oh my goodness.
And that it had two bridges connecting it with the temple, and it was built upon a massive rock. Well, if the Harama Sharif is Fortress Antonia, that's exactly what the Dome of the Rock is built over, a massive rock, which is a piece of bedrock that goes up. Now, what Martin, of course, shows is that Herod leveled off that entire area to the top of the rock, of the Dome of the Rock. And that was the rock where Jesus was judged, and Pilate, perhaps, sat. Now, there are Muslim traditions, and I'm not going to discuss those, that also have significance to Muslims. But Josephus also said that Fortress Antonia dominated the temple. And if you look at the size of the temple, of Fortress Antonia, the Harama Sharif today, it looks like a fortress. It is shaped like a fortress in a tetrahedron,
mm-hmm.
but basically almost a rectangle. But not quite, it's a tetrahedron. And it looks like if you would imagine towers at each corner, which is exactly what Josephus says were there, with a particularly large tower on the southeast corner that could look into the temple and see exactly if there was peace or riot or upset or gathering crowds or potential trouble. And that's exactly what Josephus says that Titus, the general, was able to look into the temple from that tower when they, just before they did their final assault on the temple.
Now, David, you know, according to our scriptures, there is a time coming where they will rebuild the temple.
Yes.
Is this the location that they are looking at to rebuild it?
We don't know. And the reason is Dr. Martin was going to look into that topic.
Yeah.
At the time of his, had wanted to look into that topic at the time of his death.
Mm.
He had written his book, The Secrets of Golgotha,
mm-hmm.
dealing with Christ's crucifixion. In that book, he gives solid evidence that the crucifixion took place at the on the Mount of Olives.
Right.
And if you remember the scriptures, it says in that when Jesus died and the spear was thrust in his side and the earthquake hit and the veil was rent, it says that everyone on that mountain where Jesus was crucified saw that event, saw the earthquake, and saw the temple veil rent in two.
Yes.
The only possible vantage point is from the east. And Dr. Martin shows that Jesus was crucified very close to the red heifer altar on the Mount of Olives. And he was buried there.
Now, do we know for absolute sure where this location is?
Nope.
We don't?
Dr. Martin was going to look into that. Now,
I'll bet he knows now.
But Dr. Martin wrote his book, Secrets of Golgotha.
Yes.
He completed that in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
He had just started his latest edition was in 1996. He completed his research, he began his research on the temple in 1995. And even he was loath to give up the idea that the other temples were at the Gihon Spring, but certainly the Herodian temple was on the Haran. No, then he later found out that all the temples, from Solomon to Zerubbabel to Simon the Hasmonean, which was an expansion of the Zerubbabel temple, and the Herodian temple, which was a further expansion, all of them were built above the Gihon Spring. Now, his prior research on the death of Christ had it directly east of, generally, where the Dome of the Rock would be. So now, with the new location of the temple, it would be directly east of that location. And Eusebius, the Christian historian, does talk about the church where Jesus built upon the site of where Jesus was crucified. So Dr. Martin thought that he had identified that church before he started his temple research. But later, he, of course, would have to start over on that piece of his research as to the place of the Jesus crucifixion. It's still on the Mount of Olives. We just don't know where exactly on the Mount of Olives that took place. It would have been one-third of a mile south.
Mm-hmm.
So that aspect is... has changed. But The Secrets of Golgotha is still a terrific book, and that's the next one that we're going to start work on to put on the Internet.
Wow.
So, and the reason we're doing that is so people all over the world, if you have some poor fellow in Mongolia who, you know, there's no way we can mail him a book and that it's going to get to him.
Gosh, David, we have poor people right here in our own country.
Absolutely.
You know.
And they can go to, you know, they can go to the library and print things out for 5 cents a copy, a page, or just read them. Although it's not easy to read on a computer, but you're right. But at least it's there, and if people are dedicated, they'll find the information that God leads them to.
Boy, you can say that again. That's true. Okay, with the rebuilding of the temple, they are making noises about that now?
Well, there's been rumors since the 1970s that I remember that the Jews, different Jewish temple groups have had the temple prefabricated, and they've had a red heifer, you know, located and ready to go, but they can't. Apparently God hasn't wanted to build it on the wrong place.
Right.
Dr. Martin had an idea that the next temple, there's a good chance that it might be built on the Mount of Olives, where Jesus was crucified, because where he was crucified, resurrected, and ascended would become the new Zion.
Yes.
Now, there's no water there that we know of, so that's a problem. But that's not my problem. That's God's situation to solve, not mine.
Right.
So where it will be, I don't care where they will build it, whether they would build it at the old site above the Gihon, but there's other structures down there. There's subterranean structures that would be of very great interest. And I personally don't think that they will build it at that site by the Gihon. There's too much there to discover and to deem that holy ground. Actually, Dr. Martin shows in the book, Secrets of Golgotha, that they could build the temple anywhere that there's water within a 2,000 cubit radius. So they could build it on the Mount of Olives, which is also, by the way, besides where Jesus was crucified, resurrected, and ascended, it's also where Zechariah says he will return.
where is the, you know, they have, I remember reading one time in a, an issue of Biblical Archaeology Review.
Correct.
That they had found what they believed to be the upper room where Jesus had the Last Supper.
Yeah, a lot of those identifications are
questionable,
in my view. They're more designed to attract headlines than with evidence, and they link things that are, but, you know, they get people interested in archaeology and have them support, and they sell magazines and things.
Right.
Unless they find an inscription, unless they find something written, designations are very, very difficult of something like a house. And besides, we know from Jesus' prophecy, and, you know, that there was not one stone upon another. How could you, that couldn't have been from before the destruction of the Herodian temple. It's because there was no stone upon another. Now, if that's true, and think about that prophecy. Jesus' prophecy is not one stone upon another on either the city or the temple.
Right.
That even if that was history written after the fact, it was written as an eyewitness, and nobody ever disputed that statement.
So what?
No Jews or Christians or pagans ever denied that Jesus was actual, that there was no stone upon another in the destroyed Jerusalem. So what
so,
they have
so
found
the,
couldn't have been the upper room.
Okay, so the original Jerusalem was totally destroyed.
Right.
Okay.
It was destroyed in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, but not to the extent that Jesus said the city in 40 years after his resurrection would be destroyed. Literally not one stone upon another. The temple was the repository, like the central bank, for all the Jews' treasure.
Yes.
From all over the empire,
yes.
The Roman Empire. And when the temple caught fire, which the Romans didn't want to happen, but it happened. When the temple caught fire, gold melts, and it runs in between the rocks.
Oh,
and so they literally pried every rock, they had the Jewish prisoners pry every stone from every stone so they could obtain the gold.
Okay.
And now it's well documented that the Romans used that gold to build the Colosseum with Jewish slaves.
Yeah, to kill Christians.
Yeah.
You know,
among other things.
Yeah.
And they they destroyed every house, not one stone upon another, simply because people in that time, Jews in particular, would keep their personal treasures,
mm-hmm.
their personal, jewelry and things, in the foundations of their house.
Yes.
So that they literally systematically had the Jewish prisoners ransack their own city under a sword point. So it's a fascinating story, and it's the destruction is all in Josephus.
Wow.
Exactly what happened. And it's a fascinating. And once you have all the locations correct, from obvious things like the location of the temple being where water is and the Fortress Antonia being that huge structure, which is just massive. Have you been there?
No.
Okay, I encourage everyone to get over there and see what this thing is. It's the dominant structure in Jerusalem even today.
Well, in what they call Jerusalem, is this Jerusalem rebuilt at a later time, correct?
Well, the Fortress Antonia was not any part of the Solomonic city.
Okay.
At the time of David and Solomon. It was added on to after the Jewish exiles came back from Babylon.
What is the Wailing Wall?
Wailing Wall, mm-hmm. is the western wall of the Haram-e-Sharif. And the Jews consider that part of the temple. However, most of the Jews, especially the Orthodox, you know, this is well known and documented among Jewish scholars. One archaeologist, former chief archaeologist of Jerusalem, was going to write a paper on the recent designation of the Wailing Wall as being part of the temple. In other words, it's like 250 years old, that tradition. Before then, that nobody, and once again, it was a dream by Jacob Luria, and Dr. Martin has an article on this, that Jacob Luria had a dream that this is part of the temple, and that he had such influence over the Jews of his day that people started accepting that. Well, this holy man couldn't be wrong, type of thing. He had a vision. And we respect him and love him, and he couldn't be wrong. Well, he was, because the eyewitnesses totally, there's other eyewitnesses that talk about, that the temple was not there. Let me get to something here. There's a statement by in 876 by a gentleman by the name of Eutychus, a Christian Arab church leader in 876 A.D., and he cites discussions between the Caliph Omar and Bishop Sophronius right after the Caliph and his armies conquered Jerusalem. He talks about, Eutychus talks about that there was neither the Romans nor the Byzantines ever built on the site of the temple. Now, there was a huge Roman church and Byzantine church where the Dome of the Rock is today. The Dome of the Rock is built in an octagonal shape, which was exactly the shape of a former Christian church. Eutychus said that Romans nor the Byzantines ever built on that, on the site of the temple. Now, that's true if you consider the temple being to the south. Rabbi David Kimke wrote in 126, in around 1235 A.D., that the temple is still in ruins and that the temple site was never built on by the nations. Well, that's true if the Gihon is the site of the temple. There's never been any big building built on that site. But the Dome of the Rock, when Kimke, one of the famous Jewish biblical commentators, when he wrote, the Dome of the Rock had been there for some 500 years and was one of the great architectural wonders of the world. The nations definitely had built on the site of the temple, if the temple was the site of the Haram Sharif, which it's not. So, Azariah DeRossi in 1577, this is the latest indicator. Dr. Martin has evidence from eyewitnesses from 250 B.C., and even earlier if you consider the biblical Old Testament records, to 1577 A.D., a period of 1,700 years, all stating that the showing, giving evidence in various ways, that the Haram Sharif, where the Dome of the Rock is, could not have been the temple. Azariah DeRossi in 1577 says that our, quote, our holy site has not been transformed into a house of prayer for any other people, end quote. And Azariah DeRossi was one of the famous Jewish scholars of his day in the late 1500s. Now, the Dome of the Rock is a house of prayer, and so is the individual Muslims pray there, as well as the Al-Aqsa Mosque on the southern end of the Haram Sharif. That's definitely a house of prayer, and they're building another mosque underneath in the so-called temple Stables of Solomon. So this whole structure, according to Azariah DeRossi, who did not buy into the dreams and visions of Jacob Luria, he says that the holy site had never been transformed into a house of prayer for any people. he was either mistaken or he was not, but he was an eyewitness. So, you know, you can't, he also said that no Arab, not only had nobody ever built anything there, but no Arab would ever pitch his tent there. Yet the Arabs built the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque exactly where the mystics, the Jewish mystics, said that the temple was. And it, actually, first the Christian mystics who lost the site of the temple, and then the Muslims, and then the Jews themselves. But Dr. Martin shows how they lost the site of the temple. That's why he calls his book The Temples That Jerusalem Forgot. And it's been under everybody's nose for, you know, until about 1995. You know, it's a fascinating story, and it could contribute to reconciliation between Arabs and Jews, and Muslims and Christians and Jews. So we're trying to slowly get the word out.
Well, let's hope and pray that, you know, this happens, because it's very important to many people.
Yeah.
And I, you know, it grieves me to see so much bloodshed over there, and now with the Persians, the Iranian leader,
right,
on his high horse. Oh my goodness, you know.
Well, there are prophecies that indicate that another Cyrus from Iran, will help the Jews rebuild the temple. And we'll be writing about that, doing some of Dr. Martin's tapes and writings. Be doing that perhaps the following month or the following month, because there's a lot of information on that, and we're going to be getting into that. It's interesting stuff.
Oh, yes.
So to actually cap things, Jesus' statement of no stone upon another at either the temple is still true, even today. There's nothing there of any substance. There are some houses there above the Gihon. The Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, where the Dome of the Rock is Fortress Antonia. And the Jewish temples were above the Gihon Springs, and that sources from 250 B.C. to 1577 A.D. Attest to evidence, mostly eyewitness, that the Jewish temples were above the Gihon. Fascinating.
Yes.
Do you know that the inscription on the inside of the Dome of the Rock was put there by one of the leaders of the Muslims, Abd al-Malik, who put two inscriptions, and that they were ecumenical in spiritual intent? Now, they were designed to show the superiority of Islam over what was, at that time, a genuinely decadent Christianity. I mean, there were icons all over the place.
Yeah.
And they were horribly idolatrous at that time, the Christians. And so, you know, this is what attracted so many people to Islam at that time. And now it's this flight from reason, rationalism of the current day, that is attracting this reaction to rationalism that attracts so many people to Islam. Well, Christianity has, you know, the truth is, as I understand it, from the scriptures, and that's what people should key on.
I agree, the scriptures, yes. David, this has been absolutely spellbinding. My goodness, what a wealth of information you've given us.
I do get excited about it.
Yeah. And, you know, I talked to you before about, you know, doing a series on various topics of your choice. And I look forward to that, because I know that my listeners out there will benefit greatly from this knowledge. It's solid. It's not somebody's speculation.
Right.
You know, so I just deeply appreciate you spending this time with us.
Yeah, well, thanks for asking. And it's important for me to promote the work of Dr. Ernest Martin because I consider the man, he did genius level work.
Yes, he did.
And it's just wonderful to be able to work in, with his materials and promote him, and just so pleased that I was able to know him for a period of time.
Well, I've known of his work through the book that I have, and I don't know, the Spirit just led me one day to find you and call you up on the telephone and say, hey, and you agreed, and I'm just very, very blessed that you have come on the show, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Now, hold on a minute. Don't go away. This is George Ann Hughes with my very special guest, David Seeloff. Please go to the website. It's askelm.com, and that's askelm.com. There is a wealth of information there, everybody. So go and look and study and learn and enjoy yourself, because these are real treasures. And, you know, the knowledge, our scriptures tell us that people, God's people, perish for lack of knowledge. And so I would suggest that if you are interested in the Holy Land, if you are interested in the temples, go have a look. And it is a wonderful thing that they are offering these books for free on the website in a digital format. So, you know, there you go. So this is George Ann Hughes with The Byte Show, and my very special guest, what a blessing to have him, David Seeloff, signing off. Good night, everybody, and God bless you.